Hello, and welcome to the WrestleSpecha program. I am your host, Jason, and today I have a very special guest.
He is Scott Holland, a.k.a. Star of Savage.
Welcome. Hey there.
Hey. So thanks so much for joining me here. We're doing a little Savage distancing while we're having some crazy events in the world. We're going to look at some Randy Macho Man Savage matches and try to get a little bit of distraction from the craziness. So we're going to hit two today, both of them against Jake the Snake Roberts, both of them for Saturday night's main event, the first from 1986, the second from 1992. And, you know, Scott, as one of the biggest, if not the biggest, Macho Man Randy Savage fan in the world, what stands out to you about the Jake Roberts matches and feud that, you know, is maybe distinct from some of the other things that happened in Macho Man Randy Savage's career?
I think the first thing is that I kind of think of the two of them together because they have some similarities and they're not unknowns necessarily, but both are second generation stars who definitely outshone their fathers in terms of, you know, professional significance. And they also have siblings in the business, and they were clearly the alpha in those comparisons as well. And they, you know, they both came to the WWF about the same time. Savage, who's about 3 years older, he got a little bit earlier start coming in 85, and Savage came in early, or Roberts came in early 86. But there was a lot of over, you know, they kind of crossed paths a couple different times, a couple different directions. And I think the thing that stands out, and I think we'll definitely, by looking at these two matches in comparison, is the fact that their characters didn't really change all that much. Their alignments did from a narrative standpoint, but whether they were being cheered or being booed was kind of more up to the fans and their positioning than it was how they conducted themselves, both in the ring and on the microphone, and in their other relationships. So, you know, you kind of don't always get that with, you know, the with everybody from that era where they were drawn in clearer shades of black and white. These guys were definitely grays a long time before that was the norm.
Yeah, and they were both very strong characters in their own way. I mean, Savage, much more over the top, much more, I mean, Roberts was colorful too, but Savage was very, very, you know, colorful and explosive and big and dynamic. And Jake was much more subtle. I mean, he was big, but not big in a pro wrestling sense. I mean, you know, for pro wrestling, he was very subtle, very underscored. His promos tended to be more whispers, or at least very subtle, where I guess Savage was more dynamic, but he would get very loud. He would get very animated. He'd get very passionate and kind of contrast that with the some of the quieter whispering stuff. But, you know, they were very big personalities, but very in very different ways.
Yeah, in fact, looking at their microphone styles, they were almost the inverse because both of them used quieter words and louder words, but, you know, kind of they were a yin and yang type approach. To hear a Roberts promo, you got to turn your speakers all the way up and really pay attention, and then when he really goes for it, he blasts you. And Savage is quite the opposite. It's almost all full blast, but when he wants to, you know, hit you with intensity, it's down there again on the whisper end of the spectrum, and you're looking at the eyes and the, you know, reading the lips to make sure you hear all the words. But it's, you know, one guy's a 10-90 and the other guy's a 90-10.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You talked a little bit about it, that Savage came in 85. Roberts came in a few months later in early 86. And Roberts spent 86, you know, he pretty much, his primary feud was Ricky Steamboat. They had a few big matches. They had a match at the big event in Toronto. They had a couple of Saturday Night's main event matches, including a snake pit match. And Steamboat came up on the upper hand of that feud, basically. Yeah, Savage, you know, he won the Intercontinental Championship early in 86 against Tito Santana, and, you know, feuded with Santana for a little while. He was cutting promos on guys like George the Animal Steel, Junkyard Dog, Billy Graham, who had made his comeback, at least brief comeback before his hip injury ended his career, you know, guys like Billy Jack Haynes, Pedro Morales. So Now, 86 wasn't really a standout in the ring year necessarily for Savage, although there were some, there were definitely some highlights, but, you know, I mean, character wise and just, you know, athletic wise, this might be the peak of his career.
Yeah, definitely. There was, you know, early in his Intercontinental run, he had a program with Hogan where he would take a lot of, you know, count out losses or, you know, but, you know, the house show circuit was champion versus champion stuff.
Right.
And then he wasn't, I think there was four episodes of Saturday Night Main Event without Savage in the ring at all, which is weird for an Intercontinental champion, especially given its perceptions like the workhorse type of championship. But the, yeah, you're right. It was, he's absolutely at the peak of his physical powers here. He would start to get some nagging injuries, I think, even when he was in his championship, you know, his world championship run. But, when you look at, I mean, obviously, you know, heading into his, WrestleMania 3 showdown with Steamboat, yeah. And, you know, Roberts is no slouch either. The guys are in great physical shape. You can hear it in their voices, how young they both look. And they've just got a lot of, you know, a remarkable amount of energy and, you know, however that might have been fueled by some additional substances.
Well, who knows? Yes.
I think you, when you really start to do the math and figure out how young these guys were and the fact that we're still, you know, this is 86 and they're both still, you know, 10 years later, were featured prominently, although, you know, not nearly up to the same physical conditioning, but, these guys had really long, productive careers.
Absolutely. So digging into the match a little bit, the first one aired November 29th, 1986. And not really, you know, a build, traditional build here. You know, it just, it was fairly rare for there to be heel versus heel matches on TV in WWE at the time. Much more common on the house show circuit. But I mean, basically, you know, Jake is a legitimate Intercontinental Championship contender. They make a big deal about the fact that they're both villains. You know, they do. They both have great promos at the top of the show. Savage basically asks Elizabeth the question and then immediately tells her to shut up and then keep polishing the belt and then says that's her fault if he loses the belt tonight. And then Gene interviews Jake. His hand is shaking. Gene's hand as Damian is right there. He's holding the microphone. Jake compares the stuff to Halley's Comet, your 1986 reference, du jour, and says that he basically takes what he wants. Macho also mentions to tell Gene, I think later on, that because they that he is going to skin Jake alive. So that's a very colorful imagery there.
Yeah, he's going to. He's going to wear he's going to have a Jake skin belt.
Yes, Jake skin belt. Yes. So, and what's really interesting here is that this airs, I believe, what is it, a week after, the most memorable angle of that time period for me was Randy Savage dropping the ring bell on Ricky Steamboat's throat on Superstars Wrestling, which, you know, for you and I, both very haunting experience, was kind of the thing that sealed my wrestling fandom at the time for several years at this moment. And not mentioned at all, at least, you know, I didn't watch the whole show, but, you know, during the segments that involve either man, not talked about at all, which is very odd to me.
Yeah, so the timing, this is, everything was taped at this time, and I had to look all this up to figure it out, but the Savage Steamboat incident was taped in late October 1928 in New York, and this match with Roberts was taped on November 15th in Hollywood. Now, the Savage Steamboat confrontation that made air on Superstars, I think the syndicated programming, on the 22nd of November, which is a week before the Saturday night's main event match aired, you know, nationwide, but nobody in the crowd would have known about what happened at a taping in New York a couple weeks earlier. And so, and these, you know, Jesse and Vince are on commentary here. They know, I guess, that that incident hadn't aired on television at the time that they were recording the episode. So I don't think that they necessarily would have referred to it during their commentary.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know how much post-production they did on the commentary, Yeah, because they if they use the commentary they record at the time, then yeah, maybe, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, they know it's coming, or Vince knows it's coming, or whatever, but maybe, yeah, they just didn't, they weren't as savvy about, you know, putting that kind of stuff in, you know, post-production as they were today. That's a possibility. Otherwise, it seems like a strange decision, and certainly they're going to hit it pretty hard after this, so it wasn't lost on people, but it does seem, you know, a bit of an oddity.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned earlier the series that Roberts and Steamboat had on Saturday Night's Main Event earlier in the year. And a very similar incident where Roberts, their first match went to a no contest because Roberts attacked Steamboat outside the ring and DDT'd him on the concrete floor.
Right.
And gave him, from what I can tell, gave him a legitimate concussion. And they did the whole, they carted him out. His wife was there and terrified. So he'd already had one, you know, white meat baby face injured on television, you know, carted to the back and everybody's all hushed and quiet. And so, you know, he's kind of he's just this unspoken figure in the match between the two of them. They both had their shot at putting Ricky Steamboat out of action within just a few months of each other.
Yeah. You know, I always kind of thought about this match as the setup for Jake's face turn, you know, because it's kind of the last major match before that happens early in 87 when he gets involved with Honky Tonk Man. But that wasn't necessarily the plan, which I think is really interesting.
Right. The crowd is chanting for the DDT, audibly so. Not that, you know, Savage is necessarily, you know, he's not on the fringe of turning into a good guy either necessarily, because like we said, he's about to, you know, double down on his evilness with Steamboat. But another thing that was discussed at the time was the idea of Roberts and Hulk Hogan being in a world championship feud. Apparently there was the footage doesn't even exist, or at least hasn't been released from what I can tell, an episode of the Snake Pit where, you know, Jake is the host and Hogan is the guest, and it's, you know, a play on the pythons of Hogan and the real snakes and whether or not Hogan would turn his back on somebody he's afraid of. And allegedly there was an episode of that recorded where, you know, Roberts lays out Hogan with the DDT to set up a world championship program between the two of them. I guess that would have been somewhere between the Orndorff and the Andre feuds for Hogan. But the story is that McMahon was there for the taping and the crowd responded positively to Roberts, you know, again, with the DDT chant. And, you know, I think this was also a time where there was a lot of uncertainty about whether or not Andre would be healthy enough to do the WrestleMania 3 match. So Vince was probably juggling a lot of different options at the time. But they, you know, they scrapped the idea to have Jake go full heel, but they weren't ready to pull the trigger on him going full face either. So he was just kind of existing in this odd medium place where he kind of lived most of his career. Like I said earlier, whether he was being cheered or booed, he was always, you know, the same type of, you know, even when he was a good guy, he was still giving Mean Gene the heebie-jeebies in the backstage segments and things like that. So,
right. Yeah. He didn't change. He didn't really change his tactics as much as he changed his strategy versus who he was, you know, focusing on, whether it was focusing on the, you know, intimidating the good guys or intimidating the bad guys. But yeah, sure, he pretty much was the same either way. Yeah.
Yeah. You put a snake on George Wells or you put a snake on Ted DiBiase and just either way.
Yes. No. Yes. Yeah. Yep. That's really interesting. I kind of forgotten that was, you know, a thing there. And like you definitely, we're going to get into this part later. I'll mention this a little bit later on because there's a key point in the promo that Jake does later in the 92 feud that I think I want to bring that up. But sure. Get into the match. So, you know, we got Jesse Ventura, Vince McMahon on commentary. Jesse takes the time to chastise Vince for being horny for Elizabeth, which is always a good bit. And then Jake, you know, intimidates Elizabeth with a snake a little bit, then points it at Macho, and Macho does the usual thing where he goes behind Liz and puts Liz in front of it and does so. But, you know, pretty much, you know, it seems like Savage is wrestling this fully as a heel, and then Jake is, you know, he's cheating a little bit, and he's, you know, he's doing the thing, but he's definitely, you know, if the plan was to have them cheer for Savage or have them kind of pick between both, it seems like the match is wrestled in a way in which they're intended to boo Savage and cheer for Jake. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think that's definitely fair. It's if Jake is cheating, it's more of a tit for tat type of approach,
right?
You know, trying to keep pace, and there was nothing that you would take away from this that would make you think they were trying to position Savage as a hero.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So Macho here, all yellow. Jake is in red with some black snake trim. They kind of feel each other out technically. Then Macho repeatedly pulls Jake down by the hair. Jake gets a nice arm drag. Macho backs off and then scurries away once he realizes he's near the snake bag. Some usual stuff that guys would do with Jake, but very effective. They definitely do not waste any motion or time here. Everything here is, you know, it's a short-ish match, like 9-ish minutes. So they don't have a lot of time, but they really do, you know, they everything seems to be purposeful here. There's no kind of wasted time that doesn't seem to be meant for something, you know.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely well packed together, and there's a commercial break, but unlike current television, the break pretty much they come right back to the exact
spot. Moment. Yes. Yeah. They don't even try to hide it. Exactly. So then Jake works a side headlock, and they for a little while they both time to take some time to pull each other's hair. Jesse enjoys this very much, but does not appreciate Vince's joke about his balding. In fact, Jesse's wearing an outrageous toupee at this point, as shown in the cold opening. I believe this was Predator time, where Jesse was filming Predator. I know that he, I know though this would have been around the time in which that was happening. So
he was definitely considering Hollywood his home base at this point.
Right. Yes. So, Jake teases a DDT on Savage, but Macho slips off and scurries away again, goes out of the ring. Jake chases after him, gets him back in the ring. Savage runs off the rope, but runs into a boot from Jake. Jake tries another DDT, but gets shoved in the corner. Macho gets a few jabs in. Then Jake ends up charging Randy in the other corner, runs into a Savage boot, which leads to our first near fall. And then we get a bunch here. We get Savage basically alternates between one move and then pin attempts. There's like four or five of them, but Jake sort of keeps his spirit, lands a sharp uppercut, but then Savage cuts him off to maintain control a little bit. And we get a nice snap off of the ropes from Savage, which gets another near fall. Jake this time getting his foot on the ropes. Savage then grabs the foot, but then we get another kick out. And again, I think we've had 8 pin attempts by Savage in 3 or so minutes, which was a little bit, I guess, a little unusual at the time.
A little bit, yeah. That it was something you might see. You know, Savage, I definitely abandoned that later on in his career as he kind of moved up the card. But that was kind of, you know, and I mentioned that feud he had against Hogan earlier. That was one of his... the earlier tools in his toolbox was kind of going for that. I think it was just to communicate that he was looking to get not necessarily an easy win, but would be willing to pounce and try every possible opportunity. But you definitely don't see that. It's one of the few things from this match that kind of sticks out anachronistically compared to a lot of their other motions that hold up, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And then Savage ends up tying Jake in the ropes. And then for some reason, he grabs the snake bag and sticks it under the ring as we head to commercial. It's a little bit of an odd. I mean, I guess I see the purpose of it because he doesn't want it to be there. But he hasn't really been, or it was weird that he was intimidated by it. And now he's okay with grabbing it. But I guess, you know, he got a little bit of bravery in those few minutes. So good for him.
Yeah. 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 That tying when Savage ties Jake in the ropes, it's not explicitly foreshadowing, but if you're watching it with the benefit of hindsight, it definitely has that vibe.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So we come back from the commercial. Jake has freed himself while Macho's on the opposite apron, taunting the crowd. He crouches and waits and then catches Randy with a knee lift as he turns around. And then Jake brings the Damien bag back in the ring. He and Macho trade some blows. Jake gets a short arm clothesline, but Macho gets his leg on the rope. And then Jake teases a DDT, but actually instead hits a face first suplex. Another kind of unusual move. I don't think I've ever seen him do that before.
Jesse and Vince were, I'm sure there's a name for it in the wrestling world, but at the time they had never seen something like that.
Right. Yeah. It's still a fairly unusual move, you know, probably more common now, I'm sure. But yes. And then Jake points at Liz during the pin attempt. Savage gets his foot on the rope. Then Jake holds that foot, tries another pin, but then Randy gets the other foot on. So that was a nice little thing they were doing. And then they brawl for a bit. Jake tries another DDT, but Randy grabs the ropes. They end up outside, but then Randy puts Liz in front of him again. Jake goes after the bag, but then Randy slams him into the post and then jumps off the top rope, hits the axe handle. And then back in the ring, Randy hits another axe handle from the top, but only gets two. He tries it again, but then Jake catches him with a punch. They both end up brawling outside the ring and in, and as Dave Hebner tries to break it up, they both shove him away. Truly, we're in a Donnybrook here. Savage tosses a chair inside the ring as Hebner calls for the bell. And then Jake gets the snake out as Hebner and Savage are fighting over the chair. And then Randy gets chased away. And that's it for the match.
Yeah, if you, like I said, and we'll get into some more of it later, but definitely that axe handle off the top rope is also, I mean, it's something that Savage is known for in a lot of contexts. So it's not necessarily a direct link to the Steamboat thing, but it is kind of jarring if you know the context of when these matches were airing on television, to see him coming off the top rope, you know, that danger follows.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, their main interaction, I mean, you know, they interacted at certain points, you know, in Royal Rumbles and in other situations. Interestingly enough, Savage and Roberts were together on a team along with Ricky Steamboat, and they made a big deal about Ricky Steamboat and Savage, you know, being on the same side after, you know, their big feud at the 87 Survivor Series. In fact, they survived the opening match in which they teamed with Bruce Beefcake and Jim Duggan to beat Dangerous Danny Davis, Harley Race, Hercules, Ron Bass, and the Honky Tonk Man. So
yeah, it was definitely. I watched that match last night as well, and it was that ended with Honky Tonk bailing for a count out after the right. The good guys refused to pin him, and they were talking about how he was basically facing all of his championship contenders at the time.
Right.
But it was certainly weird to, you know, both, you know, like we said earlier, both Savage and Roberts had put Steamboat out of action in well-publicized moments, and there they all were on the same happy side of the fence. So.
Yeah, well, you know, you switch over to being a good guy, you don't tend to forget, although Savage was an exception to that. He tended to hold grudges. There were multiple times during a couple times in WCW where, you know, he like after the big feud with Flair tried to ask him for help enlisting him against Arn Anderson and Brian Pillman when they were, you know, feuding in late 95, and Savage refused to help him because of their previous feud. And then when Kevin Nash was trying to get DDP into the Wolfpack, you know, they made a big point about, you know, it was almost unanimous that the Wolfpack wanted DDP back in, and they you know, cut to Savage, and Savage has kind of a sour look on his face. So, yeah. So, you know, that was always kind of a trademark of Savage's. He was like the one guy who didn't always forget, you know, who his previous enemies had been.
Yeah, and so from that point, they really kind of back into the WWF, into the 90-91. It was interesting. They didn't really, you know, Savage. You know, he had the Mega Powers run, while Roberts was kind of that bumped him down the good guy side of things. And then, you know, Savage had the thing with Hogan, and then they split up, and then he had the Macho King run, and during all that, there really wasn't a ton of Robert Savage interaction, although they were kind of involved with the same type of people. So whereas Savage was feuding with Dusty Rhodes, you know, and the Sapphire and Sherry interactions and everything, you know, and Ted DiBiase got involved in that. You know, Roberts was kind of, he would pick up a feud with Ted DiBiase as it related to the Big Boss Man turning into a good guy and, you know, stealing the $1 million belt. And they were all kind of in the same orbit, but they didn't really work a program together. While Savage was definitely one of the leading heels in the company, and Roberts was, you know, I don't know if you'd say he was ever a clear number two to Hogan, because we were always trying to ascend the Warrior, or somebody else. You know, Hogan and Roberts did team up on at least one Survivor Series, not against Savage's team. So they were just, you know, but they were definitely mainstays in that time where WWF was just absolutely the dominant cultural force in terms of pro wrestling. You know, they would be on all the lunchboxes at the same time, certainly in the first run of action figures, but they didn't have a ton of direct interactions definitely in the Macho King era.
Right. And a feud would have made perfect sense between the two at some point. I mean, they definitely, as you mentioned, they're pretty much on the same level during those times. They're pretty much interacting with the same guys on opposite sides. It is, you know, kind of surprising in retrospect, but they never did anything together at that point, probably for the best, because I think the fact that it was pretty novel, them interacting in mid 91, 92, I think added, you know, something to the fact to their feud. It was two long time guys who hadn't really interacted much. So I think that actually helped that a little bit. But yeah, I would say Roberts was pretty much a top five, you know, face side, you know, in terms of popularity, in terms of position, you know, during his, you know, basically from, you know, 87 to 91, like he and probably top three at certain points. Yeah, probably never quite number two. You know, you could argue popularity maybe at some point, but, you know, he was more, you know, he was a little bit more of like a cult fave than a, you know, like all around fave, I guess, for lack of a better term. But he was definitely, you know, up there in popularity. You know, I remember the pop he gets, I think, in the 90 Rumble is just like absolutely incredible. It's like one of the loudest ones. It's the Miami one. I think that was 90. Is that right?
Yep. Early in the 90 Rumble.
Right. And it's kind of out of nowhere. I mean, it's great. I mean, it's I think, you know, there's some heels who are dominating there, so he's the kind of the guy who's clearing them out. But yeah, it does stand out as like a whoa, you know, this is a really, I think part of it is just a really hot crowd, but they absolutely, I mean, he got, yeah, I think maybe the loudest reaction out of anybody outside maybe Hogan on that show.
Yeah, definitely early in that match. That's you're exactly, yeah, he's the fourth entrant in that match, and it's he's coming in to Ted DiBiase has cleared both Coco Beware and Marty Jannetty at the start of the match.
Okay, and
Roberts comes in and kind of sets the new tone, as you know, and Savage actually follows him as number five in that match.
That's right.
Does eventually eliminate Roberts after they've both been in there for about 10 minutes. But yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, Coco Beware and Marty Jannetty are kind of served up as patsies to DiBiase. Right. Obviously, in the context of, you know, we've seen much more dominant runs at the beginning of the Rumble, but you know, DiBiase was kind of penalized into having the first pick, and you got the sense early on that he was, you know, maybe not going to run the table, but no, Roberts is definitely the antidote to that.
Right.
And that the crowd erupts instantly. So.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I think we probably did an entire episode on that.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. I'm sure. So getting into setting the scene for mid 91, you know, we start off, of course, you know, the key things are Savage has retired in ring after losing the career ending match at WrestleMania 7. Roberts, and again, I think at this point, mid 91, you know, had become a little bit stagnant. I think the notable thing that had happened just before this is they did the angle with Earthquake squashing Damien, you know, killing Damien in the bag, and then Roberts getting his new snake. Is Lucifer the new snake? I forget the name of the snake. It's been a while.
Yeah,
no, so
that's correct. Yeah.
Okay. There you go.
He had had that the blindfold match with Martel at
that's right, yes,
at WrestleMania 7. So that was his long-term angle at the end of 1990 was the blindness and the recovery from that.
Yes. Yeah.
And then, yeah.
Which
yeah.
I liked. I'm an apologist for that match, but, you know, but anyway, yeah, pretty good angle, you know.
Oh, yeah, I'm with you. I think they executed it as well as they could be.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, that so, but yeah, that summer of 91, so he's come off of the, he's come off the blindfold match as a hero. Savage, you know, is heroic at WrestleMania 7, but he's out of the picture as an active competitor. Hogan has vanquished Slaughter, you know, and the Warrior is, you know, we can kind of second guess how a lot of this stuff would have happened. And, you know, the Undertaker's coming into prominence at all this time. So there's a lot of things kind of, you know, balls in the air. But basically what you're seeing is, in that when we get to the SummerSlam buildup, you know, it starts the whole thing between the two of them, or at least when the fortunes begin to change. On June 27th, Jake Roberts is a guest on the Funeral Parlor with Paul Bearer and The Undertaker. And this is when he says he's going to share with the Ultimate Warrior the secrets of the Dark Side and The Undertaker. Because, you know, they were running that angle on with the two of them where, you know, Undertaker was pushing the casket. This was definitely The Undertaker's first major feud, you know, taking out guys like Snuka at WrestleMania were just kind of, well, I guess his first major feud was, talking over myself, this thing with the Warrior is kind of setting up for once that kind of fizzles because Warrior departs, then he turns to Hogan and he's a world championship contender. So basically we're trying to position Undertaker as a main event player. So Roberts is purportedly on the side of the Warrior here to get him ready for the Undertaker. Then on July 6th, which is just the next week, Savage proposes to Elizabeth in the ring on Superstars, kind of, you know, that had been hinted at for a while. So then, without going over all the pre-taped segments, but, you know, Roberts, is kind of teaching the Warrior. He's laying him in the casket. He's, you know, has him in a cemetery, digging a grave. He has him, you know, in a dark room to face Lucifer. And, it's becoming clear that Roberts is turning on the Warrior. He's not helping him. So it's become clear over the course of the story with Roberts and Warrior that Roberts has been aligned with the Undertaker the whole time. And the one of the forgotten moments in all this is the Primetime Wrestling episode where Randy is having his bachelor party. And this is around the same time. So we're a week or two before SummerSlam. So the Warrior Roberts thing has been pretty well established at this point. But there's a scene near the end of that episode where Jake Roberts is out in the lobby and finds that he can't get into the bachelor party. Bobby Heenan comes out and, you know, tries to make peace. And he's, you know, I put you on the list, or I can get you in. And Roberts is visibly upset. He leaves. And then they interview Sean Mooney, I think it is, interviews Roberts, Savage, who's standing there with Coco Beware. And Savage, kind of going back to what you said about his long memory, Elizabeth doesn't like snakes and he doesn't like snakes. And he said Jake wouldn't come to the party without the snake, so he took the snake off the list. and I don't know if that social snubbing was enough, but the iconic moment is at the SummerSlam wedding reception when Elizabeth and Randy open the box that has the gift box that has the Cobra inside it. And that gets the wheels rolling in earnest for the Robert Savage feud that right. Eventually ends up getting Randy reinstated.
Yeah. Now, did that actually air at SummerSlam, or is that like did that air later, like as like a post, you know, recorded thing?
Yes,
I can't remember.
If I remember correctly, it was not live on pay-per-view.
Okay.
It was on the Coliseum video release, but it was something that they would have had to air on, you know, Superstars and Challenge in the ensuing weeks.
Okay. All right. That would make more sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, there's basically several weeks where, you know, Savage is looking to get reinstated. Jack Tunney initially refuses and Savage ends up trashing his office. And then another player involved in this is then known as Sid Justice, who, of course, you know, had been the referee of the main event at SummerSlam, had, you know, become an ally of Hogan. Ultimate Warrior leaves promotion during this time and Sid basically kind of steps in for him. And then Savage says, well, unfortunately I can't get, you know, revenge myself since I can't get reinstated, but you know, you can do it for me. And now we're kind of leading to Sid feuding with Roberts and Undertaker.
Right. Yeah. And we've got, at the same time, we've got the, we've got Ric Flair coming into the company at the same time as well.
Right.
Which, and that doesn't necessarily overlap with the Robert story. Although it does kind of build into this, the Survivor Series, I think, is his pay-per-view debut as a wrestler, Flair. And he gets involved with Undertaker in the championship match. The way it involves Savage is the time that Flair is, you know, the commentary team for Superstars is Piper, McMahon, and Savage. And, you know, Flair is kind of goading all of them. And he ends up, you know, Savage can't do anything because he's on probation for trashing the office that you talked about. Piper takes a shot at Flair with a chair and knocks out McMahon. And then so that's kind of early October. But it's just the next week, I think, that Roberts is wrestling. And they have this match where Sid Justice fights El Diablo, a masked wrestler. Paul Bearer comes out and pays off El Diablo to leave so that the Undertaker could wrestle Justice. Then El Diablo comes back to the ring, takes off his mask. It's Jake Roberts. They take out Sid, give him a DDT. The Bearer brings out a casket. Roberts opens the briefcase, which we're led to believe was money to be paid off, but it turns out the Cobra's in the briefcase. So he gets Sid tied up in the ropes, like he's going to put the... put the Cobra on him. Duggan comes out and makes the save, pushes the casket over, gets Justice out of the ring. So Sid doesn't end up getting bitten by the Cobra. There's a couple of matches, house show matches in here where Savage wrestles under a mask as Mr. Madness, replacing Justice against Roberts. There's one in Chicago, one in at the Omni in Atlanta, because Sid was legitimately injured at the point. And they played this up on TV where Savage was, you know, Sid announces his arm injury, asks Jack Tunney to reinstate Savage so Savage could take his place on the Survivor Series team. They're really pushing the reinstatement thing hard. But Tunney still won't do it. he will not be swayed.
Right. And I think people were generally, like, I think wanted him to come back. It wasn't like, I don't think there was people who felt like cheated by, oh, he should have retired, they should, you know, force stipulation. Like, I think fan support was definitely behind him coming back.
Yeah, and partly because the Warrior was gone, so the person who he had retired against, Savage was the one who was still around,
right.
And partly because they had really and I think a lot of it was done to just draw out the television, sure. To have new content every week. But
yeah.
Also, there was very much, there's clear A to B to C storytelling points that are happening here to make it obvious why he was allowed back in the ring. Mm-hmm. And then the big incident is that November 23rd episode of Superstars, which was it had been filmed a month earlier, but that's the one where Roberts goes with Savage into the ring, gets him trapped into the ropes and assaults him to the point where he can pull out the Cobra and get it to bite Savage, which is probably, as you know, going back to the Savage Steamboat ring bell incident, the Cobra bite, it's right up there with the barbershop window in terms of just absolute iconic moments that if you watched any wrestling from in a 5-year span, you're familiar with that scene.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the most memorable ones of our childhood, for sure. You and I are about the same age, so definitely, was a very key point. And this was kind of toward the end of my first phase of wrestling fandom. So I feel like these two matches very much bookend of, when I really got into wrestling, and then right around the point where I first kind of moved away from wrestling, before the Monday Night War era. But one thing that stood out even before the attack is that, Roberts talks, he's goading Savage into the wing, he calls him a coward. He says, like, at one point I almost looked up to you, back when you were Intercontinental and World Heavyweight Champ. And I thought that was interesting because of, the fact that we talked about Roberts and Savage, they come in around the same time. They're both pretty much at the same level when they come in and through a lot of their career. And Roberts definitely would have been a credible choice to become Intercontinental Champion instead of Savage at that point. The timing wouldn't have worked out quite right because, that would have been right as Roberts came in. But like that he definitely could have been that guy. And it's not like I think less likely, but not completely out of question that, he could have been the guy they chose to be, you know, Hogan's buddy who, you know, kind of ends up inexplicably becoming champion and then, you know, turns on him later. Like, you know, that wouldn't not have been as good. I don't think he would have been as great as he is. I don't think he would have been as effective in that. But like, you could have built a strong storyline with that. I think he would have performed, you know, well in it. And I think that's something that could have happened. I don't think WWF at the time was built for that, just because Roberts didn't have the physique that, you know, they would have put a guy in that position with. But I think that, you know, it absolutely would have been something that I think fans would have, you know, accepted.
Yeah, you know, they took, you know, Hogan had that 4-year run as championship, and it transitioned almost, you know, directly to Savage without getting into the, you know, that exact transition. So you've got a good guy as your champ, and they kind of favored, you know, Savage had a really long run. He was the Intercontinental Champion heading into 2 WrestleManias. And, you know, Honky Tonk Man had a long run. And I don't know what their plans were for Steamboat before he kind of bailed out of the company. But you easily could have seen after that Survivor Series, especially if there were as many pay-per-views as there are now, or even even just a couple years at the point, because after Survivor Series, they didn't have another pay-per-view until WrestleMania 4. But you could have seen, you know, if they had a Royal Rumble 1988, they did, but, you know, an actual pay-per-view event, you know, Roberts taking the title off of Honky Tonk Man on that undercard would have made perfect sense. Instead, what happened is he was feuding with Rude, that very personal feud, and they ended up in the championship tournament, which made sense too. You know, both Savage and, or both Roberts and Rude were completely believable entrance in that 14-man championship tournament. And so there just never was a real opportunity where having Roberts as the good guy undercard Intercontinental Champion made sense in the context of everything else they were doing. He wasn't necessarily wasted either. He was rising up in prominence. But like you said, in the context of this, you know, if championships were a thing that mattered to Roberts, you know, he would look up at Savage and say, you know, you were here a little bit before me, you were more successful than I was, and, you know, you had the kind of career that I would have wanted to have. And he's, you know, definitely denigrating him and playing on his, role as, you know, being shuffled down to the commentary desk. And it's interesting when I didn't watch it frame for frame, but, you know, when Savage, he's goading Savage to the ring, and the referee's trying to stop him from getting in the ring, and Savage kind of goes to get around the referee, and Roberts comes and gets the cheap shot on him. I want to say that's evocative of what happened in that 86 match on Main Event, where, you know, Savage was messing around with the snake to try to get away from Roberts, and that just opened up a window for Roberts to cut him off and get the edge back.
So he's exactly. Kinda, you know,
I don't know that they have memories that are that long, but when you watch all this video within a 30-minute time span, it kind of jumps out at you. But they're, you know, they're both, both Savage and Roberts are absolute opportunists in the ring. And you can't, you know, as Gorilla might say, you can't take your eyes off them for a second, and they'll take advantage for sure.
Sure.
But from a story standpoint, basically, at this point, Jack Tunney says that neither man will be allowed to compete at Survivor Series. Savage obviously is injured. Roberts' punishment is he gets thrown off of his Survivor Series team. But he announces that they're going to fight at the Tuesday in Texas event, which was necessitated by the title match shenanigans.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah. Because the Survivor Series is 4 days after the snake bite angle.
Right.
And you talked about, you know, what happens after that. And then this Tuesday in Texas is the Tuesday. So that year Survivor Series was Thanksgiving Eve. So it was Wednesday, November 27th. And then, right. This Tuesday in Texas is December 3rd, 1991, in San Antonio. And, you know, the Tuesday in Texas match, obviously just talk about it very briefly, but it's really, it's fairly short. It's more of an angle than, a match. Yeah. Savage does get the pin, after an elbow, but then tries to get, further revenge, gets distracted. Roberts hits several DDDs. Elizabeth comes out to try to stop him, and then he slaps her, which, you know, very big. You know, that was that. I mean, she, of course, you know, was during the, you know, Mega Powers breakup, you know, Hogan, you know, accidentally, when he's falling out of the ring, he accidentally like knocks her over. But that, yeah. That's the first time anyone explicitly, certainly any man explicitly, you know, laid his hands on Elizabeth in WWE. Probably the only time, really.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I believe that's true.
Yeah. So,
it was. And it was definitely intentional. And it was, you know, he clearly didn't hurt her.
right.
Physically, it was sold as, you know, I guess she had been threatened, with the guitar shot way back in the,
that's right. Yes.
In the Hart Foundation Honky Tonk Man era. I think she may have been shoved to the ground at that point.
That's right.
But this was by far the most, the egregious, incident. And it was more shock value than actual physical harm, but they were selling it as if it was, completely stunning and unprecedented.
Right. So,
It's set up to continue the angle, which makes sense. I guess we shouldn't have expected that they would blow it off in one match.
Yeah, it's a fun match. I mean, you know, it's not intended to be for what it's trying to do. It works very well, but it is, you know, it's not really a, it's not a very long match.
Yeah. And so they, from here, there's a series of tag team matches on the house show circuit that made some of the Coliseum videotapes where Savage is teaming with Duggan to take on Roberts and the Undertaker. There's at least one of those on one of the tapes. They happened around the country, which probably is it's the house show circuit. So you don't want to give away the singles feud right away. Also, presumably Savage is getting back into ring shape. And the Undertaker is not necessarily carrying singles matches with Hacksaw Jim Duggan at this point in time either. So it's a good use of the four of them.
Sure.
A lot of, double disqualifications, because now you've got snakes and 2x4s and caskets and ring bells and all sorts of, foreign objects. They do interact at the Royal Rumble again. In this case, Roberts has been in the ring for a while by the time Savage enters. When it's clear that he's entering the match, Roberts bails, and Undertaker intercepts Savage, but he is able to toss Jake within about a minute of his own entry into the match. He actually throws himself over the top rope to pursue Roberts at that point. He's allowed back in the match once that fight ends, which is, we don't need to go down a Royal Rumble rabbit hole, but the rules enforcement on self-elimination is remarkably inconsistent over 30-plus years of Royal Rumbles.
Imagine that.
We're getting to the second Saturday Night's main event match, which is the actual, not necessarily billed as the blow off, but it's more or less, now at this point, Saturday Night's main event has switched from NBC to Fox. It's not an hour and a half. It's an hour, and it's more in prime time than a late night show. So they're doing a little bit more high profile stuff. This is actually a really packed episode because you've got Hogan and Sid Justice are teaming with Flair and The Undertaker earlier in the card. Beefcake is at ringside, and this whole thing is where we pivot the announced WrestleMania 2 card, or WrestleMania 8 card, I'm sorry, which had been announced as Hogan Flair for the title. Then we get to this match, and I want to say it's the last match of the episode.
It is, yes. Yeah. It closes the episode, yes.
Yeah.
So, we, our announcers are Vince and Bobby Heenan this time. Jesse's gone from the company, been gone for a while. We get a pre-match interview with Macho and Mean Gene. Macho basically recaps what Jake did against him and Elizabeth. Then he takes his glasses off as we zoom in. We get a little bit of that whisper where he talks about, like, oh, all this stuff would have driven me insane. but not me. But then he says, well, yeah, now it's time for Jake to find out how insane I really am.
Yeah.
Effective, you know, Jake doesn't get a promo immediately before the match. I'm not sure if he has one earlier in the show or not, but basically he tells the camera, very WCW style, that he can be as good as he wants to be or as bad as he wants to be. So yeah. Interesting line there. Macho Man, resplendent in lime. His jacket is lime with black trim. He has a cowboy hat. He's got tassels, pink and lime green shirt and tights. And Jake, meanwhile, is he's in black with green and also green and red kind of going up like in like a flame pattern up his yep. knees, and then he's got the white snake coming out of that. So he wore those pretty often late in his career.
Yeah, he had kind of settled into a more established look at that point. One thing that we don't need to talk about the Tuesday in Texas match, except that at that match, Savage is interviewed before the match and he stops. He just kind of runs off during his interview,
right?
And heads down the entrance ramp and attacks Jake while Jake hasn't even entered the ring yet. So he's kind of burned that card, I guess you would say, which is why this match doesn't start as hot as the first one. In Texas, he's getting revenge for the snake bite, and here he's seeking revenge for Robert slapping Elizabeth. But you know, once you've used one, you know, you've pulled a sneak attack on Roberts once, you're not likely to get the same advantage the second time. So I think there's a little psychology going on there where Roberts he's not necessarily, you know, looking over his shoulder as he heads to the ring. But you're not going to get the drop on him a second time.
Yeah, absolutely not. Begins pretty quickly with a brawl. Macho posts Jake and then they trade kicks to the gut. Savage pulls Jake's arm into the ring post and they fight on the mat outside. Not much regard for the rules here. Although Jake eventually slides into the ring, Savage tosses the chair in and then Earl Hebner removes it before it can be used. Dave Hebner having done something very similar in the 86 match that he refereed. So
yep.
Hebner wins. They like to enforce the rules the same way. Jake ends up on. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say Earl refereed the Tuesday in Texas match as well.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, there you go. So, Macho sticks his boot onto Roberts' throat while he's holding on the ropes for leverage. Savage ignores the ref's count. And then Randy measures Jake with an elbow on the apron, which ends up Jake's nose ends up being busted open a little bit. And then Savage works Jake in the corner. Hebner tries to break it up, and Jake ends up giving a thumb to the eye to Savage to take a little bit of control. Jake then tosses Savage over the top of the floor, but then Randy jumps up right away, ends up back in the ring. They fight into the corner, and then Jake tosses him out again, and Randy does not get up as fast the second time. I thought that was pretty effective the way they did that.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, you know, like in their 86, now here, there's clearly one good guy and one bad guy, but neither one of them is above taking a shortcut.
Right.
They're definitely telling a story with this match. This one goes a little bit, I believe this one goes longer than their 86 match.
Actually, this one's shorter. This one's shorter? Like okay. five and a half minutes.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So they're, but what I like is that they're walking the line between, you know, blood feud and still able to get a television match that isn't, it's still a wrestling match, but they haven't forgotten that it's a blood feud either, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah. And in fact, you know, as they get outside, Jake, you know, posts Randy twice when they're outside. And then Vince and Bobby are decrying the brutality of the match. Bobby says, someone is going to the hospital tonight as we cut to commercial. And then as we come back, Savage slowly ends up back in the ring. He reverses an Irish whip and ends up knocking Jake down. He goes quickly to the top, but Jake catches him with a punch on his way down and then follows up with the DDT. Jake then slides into the corner, takes some time to mock the crowd, waits for Macho to get back to his feet so he can attack some more.
He does an interesting thing there that I believe he signals for Hebner to count as if he could be, you know, counted out which I guess in the rules you can be if you can't answer the 10 count, you know.
Yeah. It wasn't common at the time, certainly, but yeah.
Yeah, usually you would, you know, just go for the pin, but he does, I mean, he does waste that time by gloating, and Hebner's not going to start the count because it's not a boxing match, until Jake gets to a corner and instructs him, but he does clearly say, you know, no, I want you to count count to 10 and declare me the victor that way.
Yeah, which I, you know, honestly, that's at least a reason for him to kind of like gloat, you just sit there and gloat, other than just being dumb. Like, at least there's a purpose to that, which is cool. I didn't catch that on watch, so I'm glad you pointed that out.
Twice. Okay, it took me there the you second go. Time.
Gotcha. Yeah, and then you know, Savage eventually gets to his feet. Jake hits the short clothesline and then mocks the crowd some more. And then tries a second DDT attempt, but then Randy backdrops him over the top rope to the floor. And then Randy jumps to the top rope and then hits the axe handle off the top to the floor with Jake's throat hitting the retaining barrier. This is very similar to, of course, the famous ring bell feud in against Ricky Steamboat in 1986. Yeah, exactly. Yes. And then he tosses Jake into the ring. He goes to the top and then he lands the elbow for three, right as, you know, Jake is holding his throat and gasping for air. Of course, big reaction from the crowd. And Savage once more, he goes to the top again. Multiple refs are trying to block him, but then he jumps and hits the elbow again, which is really cool. And then Savage goes down to the floor. He grabs the ring belt and then he tries to directly recreate the Ricky Steamboat incident, which is not mentioned on commentary, of course, which I wouldn't necessarily expect. But I would think, of course, longtime fans would know what he's doing there. And
The visual cues are striking.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure that they intended to, you know, harken back on that. I mean, I know they were not about they didn't really enjoy referencing the past for the most part, but I have to think the way that it was shot and the way that they did it, they were intending to do that without explicitly mentioning it. But eventually the refs help Jake get out of the way. Savage shoves down a couple of the officials and eventually he calls Elizabeth to the ring. They celebrate together. And then we close the show with cutting to Jake backstage, who says it's not over yet. And then we kind of end up ending the show.
Yeah, fade to black on that.
Right. And then later on, we get an airing of what happens afterward.
Right. Yeah. And that's, you know, Savage and Elizabeth are walking, you know, this is shown on Superstars or Challenge or whatnot. They're walking to the back and Roberts has a chair and he's kind of shuffling his feet and getting ready to swing at whoever comes through the curtain first. And it's clearly, I mean, Elizabeth walks in front of Savage most of the time anyway, but it's going to be her. And as he goes into his backswing, we see that the Undertaker has grabbed the chair and prevented him from striking Elizabeth. And that transitions us into the Undertaker Roberts feud, which plays out on, you know, a funeral parlor appearance. And then it's just a couple weeks later, I mentioned that we get the official announcement that Hogan is going to challenge Sid. Savage will get to wrestle Flair for the championship. It's around this time in the house show circuit that Savage is beating Roberts in singles matches. Most of them are cage matches. I found cage matches in Toronto, Philadelphia, Landover, Maryland. I think I have that it's February 22nd on Superstars that they show that footage of Roberts preparing to hit Elizabeth with the chair. Okay. And then that the next week, Roberts lays out. He hits the DDT on Paul Bearer during the funeral parlor. And then Taker memorably, in one of his earliest speaking roles, tells him that they're no longer on the same side. And so he traps Undertaker's arm in the casket. And Undertaker kind of drags it around like it's an appendage because, you know, but the fact that he's locked in means that he can't prevent him from taking out Paul Bearer. So that's, you know, that's where we head into WrestleMania. There was an interesting, one of the other matches I considered talking about was the Shawn Michaels, Randy Savage series that they would have after Savage captured the championship at WrestleMania 8. They actually had a match before that, where Michael subbed in for Roberts in a cage match in the Boston Garden against Savage. Now, this was at the time that Roberts was preparing to leave the company anyway. He had been promised a writing spot. I believe it was Pat Patterson's spot. He had left the writing team because of an illness, or also it might have been some trouble with the law of some sort.
Yes, right. Yeah.
But Roberts had thought that he was going to transition into the now what's a very common role where you get a lot of, you know, WWF is very open now about who, or WWE about who, which former wrestlers are in their backstage capacity and bringing in guys who never actually had runs with the company, but are still respected. And I think that's kind of the thing that Roberts thought he was going to, didn't materialize. And so I think he extracted a little bit of money out of Vince to show up and have that one last WrestleMania match against Undertaker. And then he, you know, went down to Atlanta after that.
Yeah. Yeah. Late 92, of course, he ends up in WCW. That's Sting, right? Right. That's Sting feud. There's a pretty short run. I forget how long he lasted in 93 offhand. I know he had a pretty memorable run in Mexico in, I think, like 93 or 94. Yeah. Like he wrestled Conan and, you know, he had, you know, there's, you know, like a hair versus hair match is pretty memorable. I've seen clips of it. I don't think I've actually ever seen the match, but he did some, you know, interesting stuff there kind of in between, before, of course, his WWF run in, 95, 96 again, but, so anything else before we do have a few questions?
No, I think, I would definitely, if you haven't seen either of these matches, I watched them in reverse, this time around. I watched the 92 match, and then I would go back to the 86 match. I think the least satisfying of all of them is the Tuesday in Texas match, which is why we ended up not talking about it. But, you know, watch those, that the 86 and the 92, to see these guys. They haven't necessarily lost a step. Their bodies have changed by 92. But you can tell they've learned some things in terms of how to communicate character in the ring. Not that they were ever particularly bad at it in their earlier days. Like I said, they're both second generation guys, so they came up knowing quite a bit. But they're a real, I think, masterclass in terms of packing a whole lot of storytelling into not much television time. When you really look back at this feud, you see how little of it actually played out in the ring, and yet it remains remarkably memorable.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's start with Stephen Graham. His question is, does 91-92 feud contain the greatest promos of all time? That's obviously a high standard, but I mean, I would say Savage and Jake are, you know, at that level. I mean, the promos are great, but the angles might even be better than the promos. I mean, obviously the snake angle, that's just one of the most memorable thing. And the way it wasn't so much what they said, but it was kind of how they said it in a way. I think the content mattered, but it was more the delivery. It was more just Jake being incredibly despicable. And I think Savage, you know, I'm sure I've said this on the show before, but it's been a while since I've done the show, so I'll say it again. I think Savage stands out as being one of, if not the most versatile wrestlers in history, because he was always Macho Man Savage, but he could play so many different types of roles within that. I mean, he could be the badass, he could be the coward, he could be the tough guy, you know, he could be, you know, the crazed maniac. I mean, he had so many facets to that character, could play so many roles in the ring and in angles and stuff. I just think that, you know, he was able, and he kind of, you know, played all that. He was the most sympathetic guy, but he was also the craziest, you know, like wild man, you know, just, you know, attacking Jake, you know, almost scary in a way. That he could go to all those different wells, and you know, and most, if not all, of his versatility is shown, you know, in throughout this entire story.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's probably more memorable promos that Roberts has. I think the best I liked from him in this whole series was after the Tuesday in Texas match, Oakland corners him.
Right.
And Oakland is showing none of the fear that he had in that 86 interview, but where Roberts explains, you know, the feeling he got from striking Elizabeth. And I think he says something along the lines of, you know, they, you know, I would pay to do that again or something like that. And it's, you know, you kind of remember his earlier feuds against Rude or DiBiase, where he was trying to claim some moral high ground, but he was clearly, you know, psychological warfare. And but it's, he flips that switch. It doesn't even need, it's like a quarter turn away from his good guy persona. And he kind of shows you how it reveals how on the edge he had been for several years before then, how he didn't need to make that much of a turn to just really, you know, completely flip and let you see how absolutely wicked he really was underneath there the whole time.
So next we have Ish Ratana at Deadhead Ish asks, what are your thoughts on Jake the Snake being in AEW? So I have not watched AEW, so I'm going to have to defer this to you if you have any thoughts on that.
I haven't really watched it either, but I, you know, the thing that jumps out is I have seen some highlights, and I know that he's working early in this program with Cody Rhodes right now. And that question he asked of Hogan on the Snake Pit way back in 86, you know, would you turn your back on someone you're afraid of? And Hogan does, implying that he's not afraid of Roberts. And I believe in Jake's first appearance in the ring with Rhodes, he mentions that, you know, somebody once told him to never turn his back on somebody he fears or respects. And he promptly turns his back on Cody and flips the microphone over the back of his shoulder. So he's, you know, he's working some connective threads that last a long time. Also, he's perfectly cast in the role as a, you know, an aging veteran, and he hasn't lost a step mentally or on the microphone, from what I can tell. So I think people are going to continue to get a lot out of that, especially in their empty arena phase. As we learned from just watching these matches over and over again, you can get a tight shot on Roberts, you know, even in a like a fake locker room like WWF used to use, and he fills a frame, and he's captivating even without a crowd. So it's fortuitous timing for those guys.
So last one from Brian Dungasaurus at Brian McBrown 25. Could you fantasy book WrestleMania 8 to include a Jake Savage blow-off? Do you think your fantasy rebooking would be better than what actually happened? So maybe we can try to carve this one out together. I mean, first of all, do you think it would have been better if they had tried to, let's say they do Hogan Flair and then they do a Jake Savage blow-off? Do you think that there's a chance that that's better than what we ended up getting?
No. Only because I'm really partial to the Savage Flair WrestleMania match. I would hate to lose that. I think that those two are paired together better physically than Hogan and Flair would have been. Hogan never seemed to work well with an undersized opponent, you know, comparatively. And Savage, like you said, speaking to his versatility, he could be in the ring with anybody and tell the story that he needed to tell. And so I wouldn't want to do anything that would rob me of that particular match and that second championship reign. But I definitely think you could write the story fairly easily if that was the direction they had wanted to go. And I think they were already, you know, setting the stage if they, you know, if you just let Jake hit somebody with a chair at the end of that Saturday night's main event match. You can continue that. If you don't turn the Undertaker at that point, you have, maybe they kidnap Elizabeth. But something, you make it about, you know, his continued insistence that he gets to mess with Elizabeth, and, you know, Savage has to go through Roberts, maybe Roberts and the Undertaker, in order to, you know, either get her back or send him packing. You know, if they had known that Roberts was going to leave at that point, maybe they do another, you know, could you imagine having Savage in a second career match at WrestleMania 8? You know, I put my career on the line before, I'm willing to do it again. And this time he's victorious. I don't know if you would do a cage match in the Hoosier Dome necessarily. I don't know how well that plays.
Right.
But I think, you know, I don't tend to like kidnapping angles,
but, Yeah.
But you could keep, you know, you could keep Elizabeth off TV and have Savage with a series of just more vignettes. I mean, he carried this feud for months where all he was doing was, you know, trashing Jack Tunney's office and giving backstage interviews.
Right. No, that's good. I think that would be good. Yeah. And the kidnapping isn't I think that totally would work. I think practically a cage match probably doesn't work. I think a retirement match actually that might fit real well. And then you have the threat, of course, of Undertaker interfering. Maybe Savage gets Sid in his corner or something. You don't turn Sid yet. You act as a counterweight. I don't know. There are a lot of different ways you could do, but well, yeah,
you can use the Undertaker coming back too. I mean, he never got his vengeance, or I'm sorry, the Ultimate Warrior. If you know he's going to come back, roll that into the, you know, get Papa Shango and Sid Justice out of there and roll that into the, you know, the Jake Undertaker type of thing. He's got problems with both those guys.
Or it looks like Undertaker is going to cost Savage the match, and then Warrior comes out and saves him, and then Savage is able to beat Jake quickly after that, and then you have a Savage, you know, Warrior, you know, handshake, and you know that kind of that would have been cool too. You could come up with something fun, but I agree. I definitely would not have been better than what we got with Flair and Savage. And honestly, I like the Jake Undertaker match for what it is too. Like, I think it's a complete, like, the way they set it up to just completely, just have it be a dominant thing and just completely, like, make Undertaker look like an ultimate badass for getting up from the DDTs, I think is terrifically done, you know. I don't think if you could do Hogan and Flair in a way that would have been satisfying, then maybe I would consider it. But given the circumstances of Hogan leaving and Flair being the champion, and you probably don't want Hogan to just beat Flair cleanly, because then, you know, Hogan's your champion and he has to give it up, or, you're obviously, Hogan's not going to let Flair win cleanly, and then you just have another unsatisfying finish, just like you had with Hogan Sid. I feel like that's not probably the direction to go.
No, there's a lot of moving parts that McMahon has to deal with Hogan taking time off, with Warrior coming back, Roberts leaving earlier than he was supposed to, is Mr. Perfect going to be able to wrestle again? And then we're bringing, you know, Scott Hall's on his way in.
Sure.
There's a lot going on, and you know, I maintain that if you watch WrestleMania 8 and you turn it off at the end of the Savage Flair match, it's arguably the best WrestleMania of the first 20 years.
Right.
If you keep watching after that point, it falls precipitously off a cliff.
It does. Right.
But up until that point, because then you're getting not just Jake and Undertaker, you're also getting the Michael Santana opener, but most especially you're getting the Hart Piper Intercontinental match.
Right.
It starts out great, you know, but we don't talk about the back half.
No. Yeah. It's just, and you know, your main event's Jake, your main event is Savage and Flair. It's like, oh yeah, nothing else happened after this. So,
yep. exactly.
Yep. So cool, Scott. Well, thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate you, taking some time out to talk about this. Hope everything is going well for you. Hope everything's going well with the listeners. We're in a tough time out there. I hope everyone is social distancing and staying safe and being smart and is happy and healthy and is, you know, getting us, is, you know, I know a lot of our lives are being affected different ways on this. So hopefully, you know, everyone's doing well. If you're having an issue, reach out to me. I'll try to help the best that I can. So, Take care.
Thanks for having me. This is a lot of fun.
All right. So everyone, take care, and we'll be back again later.